We would like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land in which we record this podcast today, the Arakwal people of the Bundjalung Nation, and pay our respects to elders past and present.
It's my turn. It was my turn 3 pregnancies ago.
There's no heartbeat yet.
There's no sperm.
I will do anything. I just want so much to be a mother. There's a line. There's a line. And we did a transfer, 1 embryo in each surrogate. I have learnt that I am so freaking amazing. Families come together in many different ways and we need to normalise this.
Have sex and get pregnant. It's that easy, right?
Not for 1 in 6 of us. From the makers of Beyond the Bump, we, Sophie, Jade and La, bring you Behind the Bump.
A place to share stories and shed light on miscarriage, IVF, infertility and more.
So if you're trying to conceive,
or if your friend is doing IVF, if you just love a moving story,
then Behind the Bump is the podcast for you.
Hi, Kirsty. Thank you so much for joining us today. I'm here with Sophie.
Sophie, hello.
Sophie is your name. Yeah, we're really bloody excited to hear your story and, yeah, can't wait to just get stuck into it. We would love to start by hearing, I guess, who is in your family now and take us back to then the start of trying for your family and how that looked at the start.
Hi, Lakshmi. Hi, Sophie. Thank you for having me. So currently in my family, there's myself. My name's Kirsty Bryant, my lovely husband, Nicholas Bryant, and we have a 2.5-year-old daughter, Violet, and we have baby number 2 on the way.
And how far along are you at the moment?
I am 31 weeks, 32 weeks tomorrow.
Amazing. So the end is on the horizon.
Oh, I am... Second time round, obviously, I've had some, you know, it's been different, but I definitely got to that sort of 28, 29 weeks and I was going, oh, I've got this. And then I think it was like 30 weeks and I was looking in the mirror and I'm just going, I am so heavy. I am so tired. My back hurts. So yeah, everything sort of really, those last sort of trimester, all those feelings started rushing back of feeling like, yeah, that really heavy, starting to feel like exhausted just walking up the stairs, chasing Violet around. Yeah.
I remember when I was at that point with my second and I went and saw my obstetrician and I said, I think you need to check me. It feels like she could just fall out at any minute when I'm squatting on like the playroom floor with Poppy. And he checked me and he's like, no, it's all like, you're not dilated. It's all fine. And I'm like, I honestly feel like her head could just touch the ground if I were to cough or something.
It's like, that is your bladder.
Yeah, that is big. Because, yeah, that's your pelvic floor now, my love. Now, take us back to the start. How was getting pregnant with Violet? How is that pregnancy? Let us know.
So my husband and I got married in April 2020. So at the peak of COVID, at the beginning of COVID, and we had to cancel our wedding, basically. We had to cancel our honeymoon. We had a backyard wedding with just the celebrant and 2 parents on each side. No photographer, no food, no guests, like no brothers and sisters. It was very strange, but you know, it's part of our story now. And when we couldn't go on our honeymoon, we sort of said, hey, what else are we going to do? Let's have a baby.
Procreate.
I don't think you were alone there. I had a lot of friends who I feel like still had a number of years left of like partying and traveling and all of this. And then they got locked down and they're like, oh, fuck it. Let's just.
Well, we had also just finished building our house. So we had planned to settle into the house. We were going to go to Japan for our honeymoon. Like we still had things to do, but once the honeymoon got cancelled and work for the future was looking sort of unsure, we always wanted to have children. So we sort of just said, oh, it could take 12 months. Like we'll just see how we go. So we fell pregnant in the May. So the following month, I was very excited, went straight to the doctor, saw my GP. He was very excited, confirmed with a blood test. And then a week or two later, I started spotting and I had like a very early miscarriage. And then once I had been pregnant that first time, Nick was sort of like, oh, you know, we can just take it slow. We can just, you know, there's no rush. But by that stage, after coming from that loss, I really knew I wanted to be pregnant. So yeah. I had a natural period and then we tried again and we fell pregnant the month after that. And then I was a bit more slower, you know, going to the doctors, getting that confirmation. So I don't think I did anything sort of until 10 weeks, just because I just kept thinking to myself, just in case, you know, it might happen again. I'll just take it, you know, take it slow. And then when I saw my GP, he's like, oh, like you're definitely pregnant. Like we need to get you a dating scan. Then I needed a 12-week scan. And then it seemed, yeah, we were quite lucky in that regard. Like Violet's pregnancy was pretty low risk. I was part of an MGP on the Mid-North Coast. So I had two midwives looking after me. I didn't really meet any of the obstetricians at my local hospital because everything was sort of going as planned. And then 2 days before her due date, I started getting those early labor signs. So I was gutter walking around my my streets for the day before. And then it was a Friday. And yeah, we went into hospital and we had it confirmed. Like, yes, yep, you're definitely in labor. And then we went home and we waited another sort of 12 hours and we went back the next day. And by the time we went back to the hospital, I was already 7 centimeters. So,
yeah. At this point, you're just thinking this is the absolute dream. She's 2 days before she's due. Like, that's beautifully punctual. You haven't had to go overdue.
Yeah. The only thing was when they confirmed that I was definitely in labor, they also confirmed that she was posterior. So mm-hmm. she was head down and, you know, she was in a good position, but not optimal. So her back was towards my spine. So for me, experiencing labor was all in my back. Mm-hmm. So I didn't get those traditional, people sort of say it's like an achy period, pain-y thing that happens. All my pain, it just felt like my tailbone was going to be broken. So when I labored at home, it was mainly like in and out of the shower, bouncing up and down on the ball. And then by the time we got into the hospital, I said I'd like to get in the bath. So they were a little bit like, oh, water does sometimes slow down birth, but we'll see how you go. And I got out of the bath and I was like 8 or 9 centimeters. And then we tried standing up for a little bit longer and trying to move around because I knew gravity was, you know, going to be our best friend. But I did end up having an epidural like at 9 o'clock the next night. So this is the Saturday night. And yeah, once we got into the pushing, she came all the way down and my midwife was saying, you know, touch her on her head, you know, you'll be able to touch her hair. And I remember I could touch her hair, but she was brow presentation. So she was trying to look out instead of tucking her chin. So she ended up getting stuck and we tried and tried and tried, but unfortunately, we weren't able to use any assistance, so no vacuum or forceps or anything like that, just due to that brow presentation. And then we were told we'd need a cesarean section. And by that stage, I just wanted to meet my baby.
Mm.
I was a little bit shocked because, you know, my sister-in-law had two very quick physiological birth. Yes. And she's just a champion. And her first two just, you know, they were here within a couple of hours. She was, yeah, sitting up in the bed. We were taking photos. You know, it was incredible. She's amazing. And my mom sort of describes myself and my brother being, you know, birthed that way. She tells the story of when I was coming that dad stopped at the TAB and put his footy tips on for that week. And then drove her to the hospital and, you know, within an hour I was here.
I hope you got some of them right.
So I was a little bit, I was a little bit disappointed, but very excited to like meet my baby and become a mother, you know. And sort of from that point on, things just started going wrong from there, basically.
So you'd been told you needed a cesarean and they'd wheeled you off for one. And was it emergency at this point, or it was just like, okay, we're starting to, you know, head this way, everyone get prepared?
It was an emergency. However, there were other things going on in our hospital that prevented me going straight in. Mm. So I live in a smallish, not any smaller than any other mid-north coastal town. But they only had, it was a weekend, they were lower on staff, it was COVID, and there was two other emergencies that had taken place, one with a birthing woman and her baby who came in ambulance, and another one with a little boy and a substantial injury. He had a broken leg. So they were sort of, you know, we did take our time to get up to the anesthesiologist bay. We then waited for a little bit. We had to sign the consents, do all those things. So by the time we got in there, it was about midnight, and my daughter was born at 1 o'clock. When she came out, she was crying. They gave her to my husband. My husband held her near my face. I gave her a kiss. They did take her away. So my husband went with Violet. We only had one boy name, one girl name. We didn't know what gender we were having. So it was really nice that, you know, when the doctor said, oh, you've got a baby girl, straight away, Nick and I started calling her Violet. And then everyone sort of picked up on that, and the midwives were calling her Violet. And so that was a really lovely sort of last memory I had of seeing my baby girl, seeing my husband. They said to Nick, like, Kirsty needs sewing up, like, she will come down to you soon. He went downstairs. They didn't quite have a room for us yet. So Nick went to where the babies are all bathed, and he stayed with a midwife. And in the commotion of getting to the hospital, we'd forgotten the colostrum that I'd collected, you know, for those last 2 weeks. So his mum actually come in, delivered the colostrum. So I was lucky that my husband was with our newborn baby, obviously, but also had his mum there to support him and also had very supportive midwives around him. They didn't know what was going to unfold, obviously, but as the hours ticked on, information wasn't coming to Nick. They definitely were just trying to say, you know, Kirsty's in recovery. She needs to, at first they were saying, Kirsty's in recovery. She'll be down as soon as she can. So Nick just assumed that in an hour or two, just I would be down.
Yeah.
But for me upstairs, it was very different. So Violet was born at 1 o'clock. Nick and Violet left. They had closed me up. So they were suturing up my cesarean section. And
sorry, can I ask, are you awake at this point? Like,
yep.
So you had consciousness. They were just the norm at this point.
Yeah. At this point, they went to move me from the plank that you're on when you're in, like, having surgery to a bed. And I told them that I could feel I was having pain in my back and I wasn't feeling well. So they decided to keep me where I was. And that's when I started shivering. And I know sort of that shaking, shivering thing can happen after you've given birth, but I was, like, uncontrollably shaking. I could hear everything beeping. They were trying to get my temperature under control. So my blood pressure wasn't stable. My temperature wasn't stable. They knew I was bleeding because it was coming out vaginally at this stage. So they opened me back up. When they opened me back up, they realized I had a 4-liter postpartum hemorrhage and that they needed to act quickly. So I remember, because I was shaking, I already had my arms out on these planks either side of me, but they started strapping me in just to try and keep me on the bed because I wasn't stable. And then I started vomiting on myself. I remember asking the midwives to try and tie my hair up, and I had this really short, choppy bob, and it was really hard to tie up. And I had the nurses, trying to fix my hair and trying to suction the vomit off myself. And that's when I heard all the phones ringing. So I don't know if you've ever, you know, noticed at a hospital, everyone has phones and pagers on them. They pull these cordless phones out of their pockets, and everyone was ringing someone. So the anaesthetist behind me, he was ringing his boss saying, hey, I think you need to get down here. Yeah, they were ringing for more blood. They didn't have a blood gas machine in the surgery. So someone was running my bloods down to pathology and back. I heard them saying that they would run out of blood if I kept bleeding. So they were trying to order blood. Things were just not going well. So originally they had planned to do a CT scan to find where the bleeding was coming from, but I was just too hemodynamically unstable. So blood pressure, heart, I was just bleeding too fast for them to be able to make a plan and action anything. So I found out now that my body was in something called DIC shock. And that's basically when your blood just can't decide if it needs to clot or not. So you're just bleeding out anything they pumped into me, any platelets, blood products, I was just bleeding out. So then It was about 3 a.m. in the morning and there was a few new faces in the room. There was another woman, there was another obstetrician gynecologist, and the man that did my cesarean section finally popped his head over the curtain and said, "We need to do a hysterectomy." And I remember saying no. I was like, "No, no, no, no." And they were like, "It's a life-saving hysterectomy and we need to do it now." And I just remember crying. I was begging for my mom. I was asking for my husband. And then I remember they were trying to keep the mask on my face because I had like an oxygen mask on. But to me, it felt like I was suffocating. But obviously that was the bleeding, but they were trying to get oxygen into me. So I remember fighting with the nurses a little bit and then telling them, like, "You need to put me to sleep. You need to knock me out." Like,
yeah,
I was sort of coming in and out of consciousness. And every time I was coming back into consciousness, I would be fighting the nurses. And I remember them holding me down. It was just awful. And then they popped me to sleep and I woke up. It was a day and a half later. So they popped me into an induced coma just to let my body heal from the blood loss. So in total, I lost 11 liters of blood. And yeah, when my family came and saw me, I didn't look like myself because I was so swollen because of all the blood products and things they had given me.
Yeah.
So I remember, my mom just saying how puffed up my lips and my cheeks and my eyes were, and that just my face didn't look like myself. I mean, other than the tube that was down my throat and I had a PICC line in my neck and a few other things, but yeah.
And as soon as they'd done the hysterectomy, the bleeding had stopped. Like, it was something like they got to the source, obviously.
Yeah. So the bleeding was coming from my uterus.
Yeah.
We're not sure what caused it.
And you've had no bleeding issues in the past or anything, no?
So some investigations say that I was left too long with Violet pushing on my uterus, and it's something called atony or atony, when your muscle just can't contract back. And, you know, there are ways to fix that, which they sort of tried with the compression and things like that. So to stop bleeding, you can put pressure on something. So if you have a tooth removed or you're, you know, bleeding from the arm,
force
you can
clot.
Yeah. But the pushing may have caused the tear to get bigger, but it's very hard to, you know, look back on something. And especially in the moment where, yeah, they were just trying to get baby out safely. And yeah, they were trying to keep me alive. So, you know, I struggled a lot with the fact that I didn't get a choice about my uterus. And, you know, if you spoke to me a month or two postpartum of Violet, I would have said I would have rather died than have had my uterus removed. But obviously now, a few years later, definitely feeling very, very different. But yeah, so definitely not the way I expected to wake up after giving birth.
When you woke up, did you remember that you'd had her and
you hadn't held her yet?
Yeah, I knew what had happened. I had very incredibly strong, vivid memories of what had happened. So once I woke up and they brought Violet and my husband to me, lots of doctors and nurses and people started to visit. So with the commotion of trying to remove my uterus, they also nicked a utera in surgery. So I had a stent placed from my kidney to my bladder. And so I had this extra little surgery as well. So yeah, I had lots of people, trauma doctors, surgeons, anesthesiologists, nurses, people from pathology coming and visiting me in ICU just saying, "Hi, it's really nice to see you awake. You know, you probably don't remember me, but I just wanted to come and see and make sure you're okay." Mm. So, you know, that was really lovely. Pretty much from the get-go, though, people wanted to reassure me that I still had my ovaries. So I had both ovaries and that I would be able to have children through surrogacy. So pretty much the next day, I remember people coming to check on me, social workers and things, and surrogacy was brought up straight away. And I knew what surrogacy was because Kim Kardashian had had a surrogate. Like, it was in the world around me, but something I'd never considered for myself. So yeah, it was a lot to wrap your head around.
And was that helpful, that as reassurance, or was it too soon?
I know people were definitely doing it in a kind way. They wanted to reassure me, but it was too soon for me. I was worried that if I didn't look like I was coping, that I could potentially have my baby taken away from me. So something I've never really spoken about before, I not even really with my husband, I just wanted to put on this brave face, because every time someone looked at me, especially my family, they just looked so sad. Everyone was looking at me with pity, and I just wanted to celebrate this little baby and be happy. And, you know, I was sad that I didn't get to be there when my parents met my baby girl. I didn't get to see, you know, her first feeds. I didn't change her nappy for 5 days. We didn't leave the hospital. Like, we literally didn't see the blue sky outside for, you know, 7 days. And I was just so cognizant of people thinking I wouldn't be coping and that they wouldn't leave me alone with my baby. And all I could think was, leave me alone with my baby. Go away. Leave me alone. I just want to hold my baby. And I just, you know, I had all these appointments and people checking on me. And I felt like for the first, you know, few months, it was just all about appointments, all about checkups, everyone checking on my mental health. And, you know it was coming from a place of kindness and wanting to check on me, but I was just so worried that someone would think I wasn't coping and that I wasn't a good mum. So I just put on a brave face.
Did you feel a bit robbed, like obviously very robbed in terms of your birth not going how you planned and then losing a huge body part during that, but then also like robbed of what you probably imagined those first months would look like with your new baby, and then it's just more and more and more about this terrible thing that's happened and not about you becoming a mum for the first time?
100%. Yeah, definitely. It was everything that we didn't expect.
And how was the recovery of that?
I think because I knew nothing different, I'd never had a major surgery. I'd never had a cesarean section before. Recovering from a cesarean and a hysterectomy at the same time was just, you know, I didn't have anything to compare it to. So we just took it really slowly. I obviously couldn't carry anything, so I didn't really go outside much because I couldn't really get the capsule in and out of the car. I really struggled pushing the pram. The blood loss really played a part with the recovery too, because I was very breathless for a long time. But also, so we went home at day 8 or 9, and then I was home for 4 days, and then I got an infection. So I got an infection in what they call the vault, which is the spot where your uterus used to be. And I ended up hospitalized for another 5 days, taken away from my baby and hooked up to IV antibiotics. And they just blasted me with everything. And I was trying to get, they weren't even sure if my milk would come in because of all the blood loss and the trauma. So I was trying to establish my feeding, and then I got knocked down with the infection. So the road to recovery was, a bumpy one.
And now that you know your bub isn't going to get taken off you and wouldn't have been at the time because of this either, but I understand thinking like that, how was your mental health actually at this time?
Not great. Definitely projecting out and being like, I'm just so grateful, you know. My husband kept reminding me, like, I'm just grateful that you're alive, you know. I had a few bumpy days and I had to just call my mom and be like, I need you to come from work. Like, I'm not coping. She's been crying for a few hours. I know she's tired and hungry, but I don't know what I'm doing wrong. But I was really, I want to very expressly, like, I was very, very well supported by my husband and his parents and my parents. My husband's parents live like 2 streets away. And Nick's mum made us all these incredible meals. She, before we came home from hospital, came to our house, cleaned the house, changed the sheets. My mother-in-law is definitely a fixer, and she was incredible. And she didn't need me to talk about stuff. She didn't need me to ask for stuff. She just did it. She made us meals. She, yeah, changed my sheets. And then my mum was there to hold my hand. So,
oh, how nice that you had one of each. That's beautiful.
My mum just, the same thing, just became my rock. She didn't want to, you know, talk about it because I didn't want to talk about it, but she was just there, sort of just like one step behind me, just making sure that I wasn't going to, you know, falter. She was just like, you've got this, like, just, you know, we were stepping. So, yeah, I was incredibly supported by my family. And I think that's what got me through those first, you know, 3, 4, 5 months.
Just going back, forgive my ignorance, when you had a hysterectomy, does that physically start any kind of menopausal situation in your body? Like, does it have an effect like that on you or not because you still had your ovaries?
Yeah. So the blood loss affected my ovaries slightly. So I did get some funny symptoms, but we also could have put it down to trauma. So we talk about postpartum hair loss and, you know, the little fuzzy bits, but like I lost so much hair. And the reason that that happens is when your body's in, you know, fight or flight, when your body's dying, it redirects all its nutrients and its blood and everything towards your major organs. And your hair is not keeping you alive.
So important. So,
yes.
We can laugh now. I'm sure it was not funny at the time.
It was just sort of the cherry on top that I was losing all my hair, my body, I was mourning losing my uterus and I was, you know, I kept thinking, my daughter's going to get a period and I'm never going to get a period again. Like, how do I teach her about these things? And
puts so into perspective layers. Whinging about your period, doesn't it?
When it's like, And no, but again, like I work in a space with lots of women and of course someone comes in and they're like, oh, my back's killing me. Like, oh, you should have seen the show in the bathroom this morning. Like, oh dear. Like, and then they look at me and they go, oh. And I'm like, it's cool. Like, it's okay. Fine. It's cool. Like, yeah.
I understand
there.
People still get their period.
Yeah, totally. And I need that because I'm going to have a daughter and she's going to need to hear these stories because it's such a natural thing that us women go through. So, yeah.
And so let's fast forward because I'm sure the people listening are like, wait, but you're 30 weeks pregnant.
Yeah.
When did you start to think, okay, maybe I want another child? And what happened?
So pretty much the day I woke up from my induced coma, I was like, when am I going to be pregnant again? I knew the reality. I knew I didn't have a uterus. So when I came home from hospital, I threw out a lot of stuff. I threw out a lot of pregnancy clothes, the bump support things, like anything that I associated with my pregnancy, I just put in a bag and just threw it on the side of the road because I was like, get out of my house. I don't even want to look at you again.
Yeah.
And you thought your only option would be surrogacy, right?
Correct. Yeah. So in my mind, you know, we sat down as a family. So I have a brother. I'm the eldest and my brother is 18 months younger than me and he started his family before me. So he had 2 children already. And when I was out of hospital, the infection had subsided. Things were looking a bit more positive. My sister-in-law actually offered to be my surrogate.
Wow.
Which was incredible because obviously that kept me in a positive mental state because I knew, you know, one of the reasons why I wanted to have lots of children and have a sibling for Violet is because of my relationship with my brother. And he had had quite a battle 18 months prior to me having Violet. He actually had testicular cancer and had had chemo and surgeries and it was in his lymph nodes. So we had already been through a bit of a shit time with
and
some medical things.
And reproductive too. Like,
yeah, so When I had my hysterectomy, my brother had been told, so he only had one testicle and he'd also had 3 months of chemo, a second surgery to remove his lymph nodes out of his tummy. Like, his doctor basically said, you can't have any more children. And he already had two. So he was like, okay, I'm fine with that. And then I had a hysterectomy and my parents were early 50s and they were just floored that both of their children were now not able to have children. So that was one thing that was really hard for them to get their head around. But yeah, one of the reasons why I so badly wanted a sibling for Violet is because of that love I had for my brother and my childhood growing up with him. Like, we were, you know, obviously, I mean, Sophie, you understand, the girls are best friends one day and then they're enemies the next day. My brother and I, you know, we would fight and argue and, you know, hate each other 1 minute, but we were, yeah, we stuck together and we looked after each other. And I really wanted that for Violet.
You were allowed to be mean to one another, but no one else was allowed to. That's sibling love.
And so that was really reassuring. And then we made appointments with the appropriate people. Nick and I had our fertility tested. I had my AMH levels tested. Nick had done his job in the cup. He'd done what he could do. And my sister-in-law said, hey, can you come meet us at your parents' place? And she was in tears. And I was like, what's going on? And she'd fallen pregnant. So
was it your brother's?
So one little swimmer was just very determined. Oh. And my sister-in-law actually had fertility issues as well. So we were just, everyone was just over the moon. I couldn't stop crying. And of course, my poor sister-in-law thought, oh gosh, I've, you know, upset Kirsty, but I was just over the moon that we were going to get a baby in the family. I was just like,
because it felt like that was never going to happen again.
So between Violet and Miller, which is their third, there's only like 9-10 months. So it's pretty incredible. But yeah, that obviously had halted our journey towards surrogacy. And I still in my head wanted to carry a baby. So I was like, anyway, I'd put Violet down for a lunch sleep. It was like the middle of the day. And I had already added myself into a few groups on Facebook. I was looking for a community. I hadn't really found anything that quite fit. You know, I joined a hysterectomies group. I joined a birth trauma group, but nothing was really sort of like where I felt like I belonged. But somewhere along the line, someone posted about a clinical trial for a uterus transplant, and I was doing some research and I could see that they had stopped pursuing the clinical trial during COVID, but it was now, so Violet was in the May of 2021 was born, and this was 6 months later. So this is like about October, so before Christmas, and they were saying that it was going to reopen sort of the next year, January 2022. And
gosh, you do not waste any time. I love that 6 months later, even though you've gone through all of this, like, you're like, how can I get a uterus trial?
Oh, it gets funnier. So I ring my GP, I make an appointment because I know I need a referral. And then I'm like, oh gosh, I have to ask my mum. I need to bring, so this clinical trial was, it was for women that had, you know, no uterus, but it also was, you know, looking for them to bring a donor basically. And in my head, I was like, duh, I'll just ask my mum. So I rang the GP, I made the appointment, I shot off the email because I answered all the questions, and I was sort of just sitting sort of, you know, and then I thought, oh my gosh, I have to ask my mum.
Maybe just in passing at least.
And mum, the way mum tells this next conversation is way funnier than I, but I'll try and do my best. I ring her, she's at work. She's like, hey, is everything okay? And I'm like, yeah, everything's good, because obviously, you know, I've had some rocky days. So she's used to picking up the phone in the middle of the day. She's like, and I'm like, oh no, I'm fine. This is how I broached it. Hypothetically, if you could have a hysterectomy and I could have your uterus and carry another baby, would you do it with me? And she said, oh, where? In what country? I said, in Australia, mum, in Sydney. And she said, what, really? And I said, yeah, it's a clinical trial. It's not being done here, but it's being done overseas. Like, could you do it with me? And she said, oh, sure, I don't need it. And I was like, oh, okay, no worries. And then I was like, talk to you later, love you, bye.
It's do you want ham or chicken in your sandwich for lunch? Like, oh, yeah.
Though that you knew that she was your person to ask, like, I would think that someone with an older uterus wouldn't be like a prime candidate, or does that not matter? Like, she obviously had stopped getting her periods, I'm guessing.
No, so mum was still getting periods. Mm. So she was 51 at the time that I asked and we were doing the tests. So I had done a quick little bit of like reading and I was seeing that mother-daughter combos were the best.
Mm.
Well, also sister to sister, mother to daughter. Obviously, a random match, like a friend, is good, but there's quite a few boxes you need to tick. You need to be the same blood type, which I knew my mum was because we had donated blood together. I didn't know about us being a tissue match, but again, I was just like, surely that's
more
high
likely,
enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. I knew mum was still getting her period because we talk every day.
Did she have to still be getting her period?
Somewhat, yes.
Yeah.
Somewhat regularly. It didn't need to be, she didn't need to be, you know, obviously in a 30s, 40s, mm. but she was perimenopausal, but she wasn't getting any symptoms and she was somewhat getting a regular period.
Yeah.
So she wasn't on any drugs. My mum's fit and healthy. She goes to the gym, she runs, she's way healthier than me. So I knew she was going to be a perfect candidate. And to be honest, I wouldn't want to do it with anyone else.
Aww.
So I knew mum, again, would want to hold my hand through this. And, yeah. So the GP got back to me and said, hey, I'm happy to write this referral. I need to, however, set up a bit of a Zoom and we need to talk to Nick about this because Kirsty, I think you're looking at this with a bit of rose colored glasses, but, I want to be an ally for you. I want to help you through this. So let's sit down, make a date, and me, you, and Nick will have a Zoom. And I was feeling a little bit nervous because I know my husband is a bit of a play it safe guy. Mm. So I wasn't sure how it was going to go. But my GP explained to Nick what's part of a clinical trial, you know, what was happening in my body with having a hysterectomy. And I think, yeah, so Nick, my husband, sort of said to me, if this is what you want to do, I'll support you. I'll let your GP send this off. But hey, it might not happen. You might not fit the category. Like, you know, I knew that we'd never done IVF. So that was one of the criteria, was that we had to have 5 embryos as a minimum in storage or like frozen. And we didn't have that. So I knew coming to the clinical trial that obviously, and I mean, whether we tried surrogacy or we did the uterus transplant clinical trial, that was going to have to happen. I was going to have to do IVF because there was no physical way of me accessing my eggs without IVF. So I sort of just kept hedging my bets with my husband and saying, oh, well, either way, we need these eggs. So, you know, we'll have to
first
go down
step.
The track. Yeah,
I love step. You. You are so casual. And I'm sure it's so refreshing to everyone around you because it's like almost hard to be scared when someone's so casual.
I think that's how I kept getting through.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Every time we finished something, so we did the, so at my daughter was 13 months old and I just did, and she was still breastfeeding just overnight and over morning, but I started the injections and she sort of weaned herself. And we did the first round. First round, I think we collected 7 or 8, but only 3 made it to being fertilized and then frozen. So we were happy with that, but we needed a minimum of 5. Mm. They offered for me to have a month off, but I was like, why would I do that? I've
Not
just
you.
Done all this. No. So we went back to back. I started the injections again. And then 3 weeks later, we came down to Sydney, did the egg collection, and we got another 3. So we had 6 in the freezer, which put us 1 over the minimum. So we were stoked. Dr. Rebecca Deans was looking after us at the Royal Women's, and she was going to be one of the main players of the clinical trial. And again, she was also saying like, hey, if this doesn't work out for the clinical trial, we've got these for surrogacy.
Yeah.
Like, this is all, you know, just the first step.
So she had never performed one either overseas or in Australia?
No. but her sort of second in command, Dr. Yana Pittman.
As in Yana Pittman?
Yes, as in Olympian, six children, just been on The Amazing Race, been on SAS, like writing books. Yes. Yep. So she was actually the person that replied to my email. But until I met her, I was like, oh, this is the Yana Pittman, the Olympian. Like, she's
like, what kind of doctor is she?
She is in her like final years of becoming an obstetrician gynecologist.
How many hours does she have in a day?
I know. She's like fast forward and I'm in the clinical trial. So mum and I are blood match, tissue match. I've had exploratory surgery. So they did a couple little holes, popped in a camera. They saw a lot of scar tissue. And apparently when you've had internal bleeding, things get stuck together. But Dr. Dean sent all that information over to Mats Brännström he's from Sweden. And Mats Brännström is the pioneer in uterus transplant surgery. So we are following their protocol from Sweden. So they sent him all that information. He was happy with what it looked like. And then it was maybe like 2 weeks before Christmas and Yana rang me and said, hey, we need you to come to Sydney to do these final tests. If everything goes well, you could potentially have a surgery date of the first or second week of January. And this was Christmas. And my dad had just had a hip operation and was on crutches. And I rang my mom and I said, look, flights are going to be expensive. I know you're chock-a-block at work. Like, oh, it just seemed like it was such a busy time. It was probably the only time I sort of put my foot off the gas and I was just a bit like, oh, you know, a bit ambivalent. I was like, oh, we need to do these tests. And then Yana and I had a really serious chat and she said, hey, if you want this, you could be first. You and your mum could be first. And, you know, Dr. Mats Brännström is going to be flown over from Sweden. He's the best. You know, this is what you want. We can make it happen. Mm. And I got off the phone and I rang my mum back again. And I just said, hey, scrap all that. I know it's going to be expensive. I'm not going to drive. Let's just fly down. And it was Christmas Eve. So it wasn't quite Christmas, but it was people. The airport was chock-a-block and we got to Sydney and we had our final tests. We filled out all the forms. We did all the psychological side of it. We met with the anaesthetists and 2 or 3 days later, Dr. Deans rang us back and said, hey, we've got Mats Brännström and two of his team and all of his instruments scheduled on a flight from Gothenburg to Australia. He'll be here one day before your surgery. We're going to do a run through and then your surgery date is the 10th of January. We need you here. We need you in Sydney.
Was this all paid for because it's a clinical trial? You don't have to pay for any of this or do you have costs?
So prior to being accepted into the clinical trial, I paid for everything. And then sometimes I get help from the Royal Women's Foundation, which is a charity that runs alongside the hospital. So they help us with some of the costs, but some of the costs we just wear. So yeah, we packed up our bags. I had to tell work. I said, sorry, I'm going to go get a uterus transplant. I'm going to have to love you and leave you.
BRB.
Yeah, BRB, my husband, Violet, my parents, my mum and dad, we all drove down in one car and we stayed at Yana's parents' place because they had an apartment for us. And obviously we were trying to reduce costs over Christmas too because it was so expensive. And we checked into hospital the day prior because we had some more sort of tests they wanted to run. And then we met Dr. Brännström. He's incredible. He's lovely. He'd also had a recent hip surgery. So him and my dad got along like a house on fire, which was hilarious. And
how many had he performed, or is it like too many to count kind of thing? Like had he had a lot of success or he was still new to doing it?
I think I was his 31st or 32nd.
Oh, not many, really.
So somewhere in the middle. Yeah.
Yeah. But I knew that a couple of the first women that had the surgery were successful in carrying pregnancies and like their children were 2 and 3 at the time. So look, I knew it wasn't a foolproof plan. I could go to sleep and wake up and then say, hey, mum's uterus just didn't, you know, it, it, I definitely was very aware that things could go wrong, but I was just trying to stay in the right headspace because I was nervous about surgery, obviously.
Yeah.
And I was dragging mum into this as well. So I was like, let's just do this together. We'll see how we go. You know, this is going to be the hard part, the surgery, but we're surrounded by people that want this to work. You know, I've just had a good feeling about it. So my dad and my husband went back to the unit and they went to sleep. And then the next day, the nurses were waking mum up at 5:30 and she was allowed one piece of toast. She scrubbed up for surgery. She went and had a shower. And then me, Yana, and mum walked down to the operating theatre and they popped her on a bed and I got to wave goodbye to her. And she was in surgery for 10 to 12 hours. It until about midday they needed me in. So it was big surgery before I even got put under. So they put mum to sleep. They open her up. They need to keep veins and arteries.
I was going to say it'd be different to a regular hysterectomy, right?
Yeah, because we need it to survive in me, we need arteries and veins. So it was a very, very delicate surgery. And when they removed it, they also had someone in there taking photos. I think it was Neil or Yana taking photos. And the uterus is such a cool, amazing organ. It looked like a little deflated octopus. It was like the size of, it fit in the palm of someone's hands. Like, it's incredible the way it's just
the amount it can grow and shrink and
heart surgery move over, uterus transplants are the new thing. Like, this is incredible surgery. And they flush it and make sure that it's working and then they put me to sleep.
Is it her fallopian tubes or yours?
They don't even attach it to anything. So it's just attached by those. So I did have two.
Because you don't need to attach to your ovaries, I guess. You don't need to ovulate into it. Yeah.
Correct. So it's just held in there with like my pelvic floor and the arteries and the veins. And yeah, I wake up in recovery and I remember Matt standing over the top of me and Bex beside me. And I remember being like, Mum, where's mum? And then they pointed and she was on the other side of recovery, but she was asleep. And I was like, yes, like mum's there. And Beck's like, it's been successful. Like, you have your uterus, you have your mum's uterus. And then I just fell back asleep.
Oh, how good's that?
And then how long after, how long did you have to wait before you tried to get pregnant?
So I got a natural period 32 days later.
Wow.
That uterus is smart, isn't it?
So you have you've got like a cervix and that's all attached.
So I have my mum's cervix.
But you have a cervix. So you've got your mum's cervix. And so you get your period now.
Yeah.
Well, not now because you're pregnant.
But you don't have fallopian tubes. I guess the lining just sheds.
Correct. Yeah. So the eggs just float around and dissolve. But the lining, correct, is what still needs to shed.
And you couldn't have sex with Nick and get pregnant.
No, correct.
Wow.
Yeah. So I had my period at 32 days and then we tried for an egg transfer at the 4-month mark. And 2 weeks later, a blood test came back and I'm pregnant.
First time.
First round, first go.
Oh, my God. And that's the baby inside you right now.
Yeah. And that's the uterus you were in.
Yes, and my brother.
Aww. That is just wild.
Yeah. And I'm having a little boy.
So you've got to use your boy name now, right? It's still the same boy name?
Well, my husband wants to use it, but I keep saying it's Violet's alternate name. Like, that's Violet's name. I can't use that. But, I'm stoked. We were told at 17 weeks that we were having a girl via ultrasound. I couldn't do the NIPT test because I've got my mum's DNA, my DNA, and the baby's DNA, and potentially it could throw out a
result
saying that I'm at high risk for something that wasn't quite right. So we did not do the NIPT test. So we waited to see by ultrasound, and at first at 17 and 5, they said, "Oh, you're having a girl." So that was amazing. And then it was 21 or 20 weeks, I went back for another scan and we saw a big leg spread and we saw this little doodle there and it was great. I couldn't stop laughing. I think the poor lady doing the ultrasound, I think she was so worried that I was panicked, like that I was upset, but I just couldn't stop laughing because I was there by myself. Nick was at work and we'd already joked about what if it was a boy? And I just thought he wasn't going to believe me. And I just couldn't stop laughing. I just thought it was the funniest thing because we were almost through the whole ultrasound. We'd been saying she, her head, her neck, her arms, her tummy. We'd done all the circumferences. Yeah, her penis. And
hang on.
It's been incredible.
And so what have you had to do differently during pregnancy?
I'm high risk, very high risk. So I take anti-rejection drugs to stop my immune system from attacking the uterus. So I take tablets. I probably take like 10 tablets in the morning and 10 tablets at night. And they're a mixture of anti-rejection. I'm on prednisolone. I'm on things to help me go to the toilet. Then I'm on things to stop me from having heartburn or reflux, an antiviral, like the list goes on. So you're on a lot of drugs, but they're all safe in pregnancy.
Are they drugs that you'd be on regardless of being pregnant or not so that your uterus wouldn't be rejected?
Correct. So the second I have this uterus removed, which I will happen because the only function of the uterus is to carry a baby. And once I'm, you know, feel like I've finished my family, I can have that removed. And then I can go off all these drugs, which is just, you know, that's the luxury of this organ is if you have a lung transplant, a liver transplant, you know, you have to stay on these drugs your whole life. And it really affects the way you live your life. Whereas at this stage, I'm very lucky that hopefully it's going to be quite short term. And yeah, I'll go off these drugs and have my family.
And can you donate it on to someone else?
No, unfortunately. I mean, I think it would be amazing.
Like to try?
I think mum would be stoked if we could keep it, you know. But,
keep it going.
No, unfortunately, yeah. After me, it's done.
And you're done after this one, right? You're not going to use it again?
I really wanted to have three children. My husband's got two siblings, but we've just been so... like this journey has just been gone so well that, you know, my husband and I were talking about
why tempt fate kind of.
Yeah. And it's, as I'm getting to the end of this pregnancy, it's, everything's getting harder. It's harder for me to work. It's harder for me to look after my Violet. I just don't know how I'd go with two children and having, I've got a lot of appointments. I spend a lot of time at the pharmacy. I've ended up with gestational diabetes this time around, which I didn't have with Violet. So I'm sticking needles into myself again. So, you know, I would love to have a third, but I don't think that will happen for our family.
And what's the plan with birth?
A cesarean section.
And how do you feel about having another cesarean?
I think I was just dealing with things week to week. And now that we're, you know, booking dates and speaking to specialists and, talking about what it would look like to have the cesarean section, I'm definitely getting a bit more nervous. I've made an application to the hospital and I'm hoping to have both my mum and my husband in there, but we just have to see because there's already lots of other specialists in there. The haematologist has got things, you know, everyone's sort of got a finger in the pie because I'm covered by so many teams. So I'll just be guided by them, but yeah, hopefully I can stay awake the whole time. Hopefully baby comes out and he's screaming and he's pink and he's happy. Because I will be giving birth slightly early. He will be 37 weeks, but yeah, hopefully it's just going to be a whole different story this time around.
Oh my goodness.
Will they take the uterus then or that'll be a surgery later?
Correct. I had the option of having it, but I would need to be put under for that. And I didn't want to risk a longer surgery and having a postpartum hemorrhage or something happening and me not being able to be there. I really am excited for that sort of golden hour and
new experience,
breastfeeding. And because I do have the gestational diabetes, I'm really aware of baby's sugars. So he's going to need colostrum and things like that. So I just want to be there. I just want to be with my baby.
I'm so excited. You are absolutely incredible. What a journey you have been through. But I honestly, I just love your spirit and your, you're just the best.
Yeah.
I'm sure you've had your moments where you're not as casual about it as you are right now and as positive.
I think it's just helped having that family support. Having the doctors around me too keeps me really focused because they're just so knowledgeable. You know, Dr. Deans, this was her dream to be able to provide this service, you know, to women in the future. Dr. Yana Pittman is one of the most passionate women you'll ever speak to when it comes to fertility. I think obviously I had a little bit of that in me before everything happened, but it's definitely being fostered by the people around me, you know, my husband always encouraging me, my mom holding my hand the whole way, you know, Nick's parents always supporting us, my brother and sister-in-law. I couldn't have done this without the people around me, but then also the clinical trial.
And have they done any more since you?
Yes. So in Australia, another hospital has done one, and then the Royal Women's has also done a second in March. And not spoiling anyone else's news, but the lady that went second to me, she's doing very, very well. So it's looking like
she's glowing.
Yes, the research and the clinical trial is,
it's amazing.
It's amazing.
I can't
wait to think that when Violet is of an age, when she's thinking about extending her, like starting a family, that there's just going to be so many more options for her. And it's just, science is incredible. Medicine is amazing. You know, people, I've said this before, people, you know, often try and tell me what a miracle this is, but this isn't a miracle. This is science. This is people's hard work.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine what 2033 is going to look like.
Oh, I've got goosebumps. This is so good. Oh, well, thank you so much for your time today. Thank you so much for getting her down for a nap.
No worries. I've been so excited. I used to get very nervous sharing because I, you know, didn't want to scare anyone and I didn't want to put anyone off. But I think both of your podcasts, it's important to share stories. It's important to acknowledge other people's experiences and we can do it all together. It, you know, it doesn't discount someone else's, you know, beautiful physiological birth, you know, we're all women. We can all support each other. And thank you very much for inviting me
on.
So many
different paths.
Yeah.
Oh, it's been an absolute honor to share your story. So thank you so much.
You're amazing. Thank you.
Thanks, ladies. No worries. Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of Behind the Bump.
If you loved today's episode, you can head to our Facebook group, Behind the Bump, where you can join in the conversation, find support and so much more. It's linked in the show notes.
Until next week.
Bye-bye.